Now, I want you to listen carefully to the sound of this voice.
إذا رأيت نيوب الليث بارزة فلا تظنن أن الليث يبتسم.
Even if you cannot understand Arabic, you can sense the drama, the rhythm, and perhaps even the distinctive rhyming patterns of this poem by 10th century Iraqi poet Abul al-Tayyib Ahmed ibn al-Hussein al-Mutanabi al-Kindi. That's the long name for a poet that most people refer to as just al-Mutanabi. When the lions bare his teeth, do not. Fancy not that the lion shows to you a smile. I have slain the man that sought my heart's blood many a time, riding a noble mare whose back none else may climb. A rough translation of that poem. The language of conquest and romantic evocations of lions and noble steeds, this is the spirit of Arabic poetry. And most young people in the Arab and Persian-speaking world know the verses of poets from this medieval golden age of Islam. Listen now to these words from a translation.
Ask Mosul, city of Islam, about the lions, how their fierce struggle brought liberation. The land of glory has shed its humiliation and defeat and put on the raiment of splendor.
The poet here goes by the name of Ahlam al-Nasser, a woman married to one of al-Qaeda's veteran propagandists and called the poetess of the Islamic State. She's one of a chorus of living Arabic poetic voices, conveying, recruiting, and evoking the mission of ISIS to bring back the Islamic Golden Age on their own terms. Robin Cresswell is assistant professor of comparative literature at Yale University and poetry editor at the Paris Review. He's here with me in the studio. Robin, welcome.
Hi, John.
Cresswell and Princeton Near Eastern Studies professor Bernard Haeckel wrote about the importance of jihadi poetry in the current New Yorker. What comes to mind as the importance of this poetic voice in understanding what's going on with the jihadis in the Middle East right now?
I think the interest in poetry is that in contradistinction to other forms of jihadi culture, which is to say their anthems or the sorts of things that we see on the nightly news, the videos that they make, which are full of beheadings and burnings alive, that sort of material is produced for a foreign audience, I think. It's meant to terrify, and it often is pretty terrifying. The poetry, on the other hand, is the jihadis talking to themselves. So it is a form of internal propaganda, but it's also, I think, gives us a kind of insight into what we call the fantasy life of these jihadis.
How does the poetry really turn on this channel of romantic, a sense of adventure that might be of interest, in fact, inspire young Muslims who hear this poetry? And where might they be able to hear poems like al-Nasser's?
Well, all the poetry is disseminated over the internet. You can find it both in YouTube form. There are recitations performed live, so to speak. But there's also full volumes of verse that are disseminated in the same way. So that's where you'd find it. It's a culture that is entirely a virtual culture.
But it's mainstream. It's mainstream within the jihadi world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is, I would say, we would argue that this is really the central form of their culture. It's more important and certainly more intricate, certainly more sophisticated than the video productions, for instance. And as for the romance, they produce that kind of thing in a lot of different ways. One of the ways is that the poetry. And it's important to say that poetry really is the queen of arts in Arabic culture. It's the art form with the longest history, which extends to the pre-Islamic period. And it's one which is, surprisingly, I think, from our point of view, a continuous one. So that, as you said, pre-Islamic poetry is taught in secondary schools, and you can buy pre-Islamic poems or classical poetry, certainly, on any street corner, any kind of humble bookstore will have this kind of material. So it's continuous in a way that, our relationship to Beowulf, for instance, is not.
Explain how this poetry has given rise to some unprecedented groups, and particularly the women religious police within ISIS who are talked about, who have no precedent within Islam but are consistent with this idea of making Islam triumphant on their own terms.
Well, what we talk about in the article, we don't have a very clear idea of what goes on in the Islamic State, but it is clear that ISIS has made a concerted effort, and in this they are distinct from previous militant movements, to put females on the front line of the propaganda war. And not just the propaganda war. So Ahlam Anas, for instance, is not only a poet, but she has become a kind of ideologue for the movement. But they also have a group called the Al-Khansa Brigades, which are a kind of female morality police. As far as we can tell, we don't really know that much about them. Al-Khansa was a pre-Islamic poetess. In fact, she was the great pre-Islamic poetess who also converted, we're told, later in life and became a Muslim. So the brigades are kind of like morality police, we think, in as they operate in Saudi Arabia more or less, except that they are focused on issues of female deportment, and they may also serve as checkpoint guards. So it's interesting that they would call this troop the Al-Khansa Brigades, because it gives you the sense that this is an ancient, even pre-Islamic sort of institution, whereas in fact it's a radically new one.
How would this poetic voice be a recruiting tool? Can you describe how a young person might hear what's being asked?
Well, I think what's at the center of the poetry is the question of identity. These are poets who are modeling what it means to be a virtuous and authentic and heroic Muslim. And it's also modeling a certain kind of community. It's a poetry that's all about the sociable occasions on which it's recited, and also that's about building an Islamic community. And so I think for those who lack that sort of community for one reason or another, because their communities are falling apart due to war or because they feel themselves to be alienated in whatever foreign country they
are. Or annoyed by their parents.
Just kind of teenagers. It gives you that sense of community.
Osama bin Laden was a poet. You remind us in this article that he is very much a poet in the eyes of the people who followed him.
Yeah, not only a poet. Certainly part of his appeal as a leader and his charismatic appeal as a leader was in his eloquence. And part of that eloquence was being able to produce verse. So he wrote poetry on a number of occasions. He recited it himself. He also recited the poetry of others. And interestingly, the poem that we talk about in the article is an imagined dialogue between bin Laden and his son Hamza, which is all about the Al-Qaeda chief handing down a certain kind of disposition, ethos, kind of ethical values to his son. And that's something that I think we maybe don't take enough into consideration, that there is a culture of jihad, that it goes across generations, and that's one of the reasons why it's so persistent, why it's so durable.
Robin Cresswell is assistant professor of comparative literature at Yale University and poetry editor at the Paris Review. He's the author, along with Near Eastern Studies professor at Princeton, Bernard Haeckel, of an article in The New Yorker about the power of jihadi poetry. Thanks so much, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.